Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming. For those of you that, I'm sure most of you know me, but for those that don't, I'm John Coombe, and Amanda and I grow daffodils at Trenowith. It's very easy to find us in the winter. All the muddy roads lead to our lane. We try and keep it as clean as possible, sometimes with very little success. The story tonight starts way back in the 1800s. For centuries, the daffodils had grown wild in this country, mainly based on the Lent lily and the Tenby daffodil. And these had just grown in the hedgerows, the Lent lily being grown more into the southwest. And there were a number of Victorian enthusiasts who were touring around Europe, and they discovered that on the snow melt lines of the Alps, as soon as the spring came up, a lot of daffodils would appear. So they were dug up and they were brought back to particularly Cornwall, and here they grew and thrived very quickly. But the first real sendings of commercial daffodils was not done here, but on the Isles of Scilly. It was in 1870 that William Trevelyan was out, quite a bit of a gentleman farmer, I think, was out strolling across his fields one day, and he was admiring the sol d'ors and the Scilly whites that had grown wild in the hedges and the fields for a long time on the Scillies, never on the mainland, but on the Scillies. And he'd never seen them look better, so he decided that he would gather a few up and put them in a hat box and send them off to London Covent Garden and to see what happened. And they off they went, and it was some days, I believe nearly a fortnight, before he got a return from Covent Garden. And this was all wide open that he gathered, things like this, and he received the amazing sum of 7 and 6p. He could hardly believe it. I mean, that was over a week's wages for a man in those days. That was tremendous. He sent another box, and he received the sum of £1. Well, that was enough for the islanders. They were away. And here you'll see on the next picture, it didn't take them long to build up their supplies. Obviously, the price didn't stay at that. But that really was the beginning of the daffodil sendings, which started on the Isles of Scilly. And they went on that way for another time. Here they are loading the boats down at the quay, waiting to take the boxes to Penzance to go up by rail. The sol d'ors, the Scilly whites, were entirely to the Scillies. It was in 1885 that Andrew Laurie, down at Varfell, which is now Winchester Growers, he started thinking that there was an idea that there would be a commercial production for daffodils, because a number of these enthusiasts were developing new varieties. And he was the first mainland grower to send daffodils up to Covent Garden. The potential for daffodils was soon realised. So the sols were confined to the Scillies, and the production began, with more varieties being needed, and enthusiastic breeding had begun. And one of the most enthusiastic and the most successful of all this breeding was none other than P.D. Williams of Llanarth, and that's just up the road there at Llanarth Estate. He was an amazing breeder, and he's there with his variety Carlton. Carlton went on to become the most widely grown variety of daffodil in the world and held that title well into the 70s and the 80s. Well, about 1980, it began to lose some of its shine, but it's still grown a lot, mostly in East Anglia and across the world. But the trouble is, growing was very, very labour intensive. And here you can see... Sorry? Oh yes, and St. Kevin, yes. Sorry, the other variety that he grew was St. Kevin. That's a lovely show variety. It had its problems, but it was still a very nice variety. But it grew very abundantly because it was not susceptible to the basal rot. But the growing of all the bulbs in those days was very labour intensive. They ploughed a long, straight furrow up the field. It had to be very straight because they had to lift them again simply by ploughing them out. And for the planting of them, they dropped them laboriously one at a time, nodes up, roots at the bases at the bottom, and then they would be covered in then by the next furrow. These here were then planted, and then they could be then sent to Covent Garden. For our area, which was starting to do this, they could be using the station which was being built at Helston. There was much increase in all of the bulb production right up until the First World War. And then, of course, there was a major problem. There was shortage of food, land had to be ploughed, and so the ground was turned over for food production, and the stocks themselves were decimated, and they only survived in small paddocks and in hedgerows. After World War I, the demand was still strong. In spite of the recession, you thought there might not have been, but it really was a great demand for it. And they were then done in the tying sheds, where you can see that the bunches then were done nearly entirely by the ladies. The men were out in the fields carrying these big open blooms in big baskets and, if you like, coffins, they used to call them, on their shoulders. When they were wet, they were very, very heavy. And here we have, I've done one, they bunched them on cradles like this. Yes, please, yeah. This is one that I'd bunched up there. It's a cradle exactly the same as they are using. And they would pick them, again, fully open, and they would... That's better. And they would come out like that, and they were packed and picked in that condition, and they were bunched accordingly.
That's fine, Karen, thanks. Yeah, that's better.
Something happening back here.
What is that?
A woodpecker, I think. They were packed in wooden boxes, just like this. This is one of them that was used. If I can quickly open it, if you can open the other side there. They were all tied down and loaded on those carts that you saw. And you come up with something like that. These are quite far gone, but they were not picked quite as open as that. But very much in that sort of direction. You can come up, I'll leave it there. You can have a look at that after if you want. And these were then dispatched from the islands by Great West Railway at Penzance. An expansion then increased throughout the bulb industry, the whole of Cornwall, including St Kevin now. We were by this time in on this scheme. And then with the outbreak of war, the land was then ordered to be ploughed up again for food, and the total acreage in Cornwall was reduced from 2,000 to just under 500 acres. Also, they were not allowed to transport them on the trains. Although I've always heard from Kovrak that if servicemen were going back to London, they were sometimes encouraged to take flowers back in their luggage and sell them. At least they got some money for them. But there was a change. The Isles of Scilly growers were very clever. They had nothing else to sell, really. There wasn't a lot of food produced on the islands. And so they sent a box of beautiful scented soldors to Winston Churchill, and he was so impressed with them, and he loved them and the fragrance, that he said the ban should be lifted, and that they should be able to send them to Covent Garden so that the people could enjoy, have a bit of joy in their darkest of hours. The next day, Cornwall's growers sent up 1,000 boxes. After World War II, there was yet another increase in production. But along with production, there is always a lot of problems, and they're exactly the same problems in growing daffodils then that we have today. We have the eel worm, which devastates the crop, basil rot, and fungal problems. And in order to address this after the war, the Ministry of Agriculture established a station at Rosewarne at Camborne into research into daffodil production and to the diseases. And joining on to that was a remarkable lady that joined the staff, and that was Barbara Fry. Now, Barbara Fry came to Cornwall as a land girl and then joined Doris Long down at Trenewith Valley Flower Farm, which is where Amanda and I live some of those fields now. And she got enthused into the breeding of new varieties of daffodils and trying to breed them earlier and against resistance. And even down there now, at this moment, we still refer to the buildings at Trenewith as the Queen Mary, because it was the stoke hole and the big chimney at the back, which the smoke poured out. The lights from the louvered holes on the walls were like the portholes, and this would burn day and night in order to force the blooms open. They had hot pipes running right around the walls because they had to sell them in this sort of condition here. They would no way do what we do at the moment. PD died in 1935, but his varieties were exploited. Carlton became known and famous worldwide, and St. Kevin moved then in a completely different direction. That variety, it was noticed by Barbara Fry, with its resistance to basil rot, was then put into a lot of other varieties. It had this brilliant golden yellow trumpet and that resistance, and it made it apparent in many of the much newer varieties. Before he died, PD, I think I'm right in saying that he raised over and named over 75 different seedlings, and that is an amazing number. It takes anything up to 10 to 20 years to see whether a seedling is worthwhile or not. He really was dedicated to it. But this enthusiasm that Barbara got at Trenewith stayed with her, and when this experimental farm opened up, she jumped at the opportunity to go up there. She joined it in 1958, and by 1964, she was totally in charge of the breeding program. I've got here somewhere, so here we are, some catalogues of that day, or roughly that era, and it is amazing that the price of some of these bulbs, you can look at these after, the 67 one, they're beginning to sell them in hundreds and thousands, but they're still being sold in dozens, 5 and 6, 11 shilling, that's for just a dozen bulbs. There was a lot of money in those days. And down at Trenewith, I'm told, John Nichols said, they used to have, by auction, a dozen bulbs would be carried around, shown to people, gathered around the big Queen Mary, and they would bid on those bulbs. But there's an even earlier one, it's undated, but I think it must come from the 50s. And here they've got bulbs, 5 shillings, 7 and 6, 20 shillings each. I mean, that's a colossal amount of money. Plus, the attrition rate was very high. You lost a lot of those with bulb fly before they were able to use Aldrin. Bulbs are always sold by the dozen, or individually on trays carried around for the people. But there then, as always happens in all industries, there has to be a seismic change, and that took place then. The enthusiasts wanted this: beautiful blooms, wide open, full colour. But the growers wanted money. And they argued that we could get much more if we picked them in buds, that we didn't have to waste all this time tying them in sheds. We could actually bunch them in the field. We could use cardboard boxes, and that would save a lot of all these wooden boxes going up and down by train. And so I can just remember this debate taking place. It was very strange. They were the older school that enthused very much about the type of daffodils. Both sides spoke passionately about what they wanted. Each side was very polite to the other. There was no There was no swearing or anything like that. And I think it was because both sides were right. Those of you that want show varieties, you grow the open blooms. You pick those. You don't pick tight green sticks. But commercially, we could no longer, we just could not afford to pick and bunch those and send them up by rain there. The transport costs would be prohibitive. And so eventually, the debate, which dickered back and forth for a long time, but they came to win by picking them in the bud. And here we are. This is the sort of thing we see in the fields nowadays. They have better bloom if they're open, but they damage more. You get a better vase life for them. There is always a downside. One of the downsides is this, the banana. We often get it. The flower will open perfectly, but I'm afraid it doesn't look very nice when you're comparing that to that. But that is the way the industry want, and that's what they, and that is what they wanted. With the newer varieties, the modern daffodil industry now was really gearing up. This is our little farm, and we actually, incidentally, are very small daffodil growers in these days. That there is picking intensive. It's in fact Delyn that we're picking at Trenewth. Is it Delyn? Yeah, it's Delyn. And this goes on in all the fields in different times depending upon the variety. Later on, you'll see them being picked up into their trays. They're stationed at the end of each of the rows, and they all put their bunches in them, counted to the number they're told to put in, with their individual tickets on, so we can trace them back as to who are good pickers and who need a bit more encouragement. And then they're loaded on into carriers. This here is just taking them on and off the carrier when it comes into the yard. And there they removed and put into the cold storage or into the lorry for transportation, whichever is necessary. The variety raised by Barbara, having gone from Trenewth to Rosewarne, really are the backbone of our industry today. There's not a daffodil grower in the county that does not grow some of Barbara's seedlings. She's got varieties that came from Rosewarne that flower from before Christmas until, I suppose, the end of March. A rough example would be you start with Tamara, which is very early, Jedna, they come around the Christmas time, Rosenwyn, Berenwyn, and then Delyn is one of the later varieties. And they are now the backbone. The pictures you see on the walls there, they're varieties. There are some of which are still grown, but they're tending to fade away, and we're replacing them with much of the Rosewarne seedlings. And here you can see, look, you've got Jedna and Tamara. This is coming up at Christmas in the snow. It's a great difference from the old Lent lily, which was just before Easter. And then you've got Tamara that was, you know, developed by Barbara Fry. What she did, the Rheinsfelds early sensation, which were the very early ones that were cut. They used to come in the end of November, December, but they were very short. And she crossed that with Trenance, just down the road from here, which was another variety, and they got Tamara. Tamara is not a good show daffodil. It's a bit pale in colour, doesn't have a particularly nice trumpet, but it is very early, it's very strong, and a very heavy cropper. And there's a lot of growers that have made many, many hundreds of thousands of pounds out of growing Tamara. And that's entirely down to Barbara. And now we move on to comparing some of the changes we have with modern growing. Back in the old days, as I said, it was a straight furrow, very slowly up across the field, planted by hand. Now, that's the modern bed forming, one man in a tractor, a way to go. And they're done on much bigger scale than that in different parts of the country. You had the hand planting here, one bulb at a time, nose up, base down. Now they're just heaved into a planter, and they're just trailed out. Some are the right way up, some are upside down. The planting rates have gone from, I don't know, probably no more than 2, possibly 3 ton an acre, up to now where we're 8, maybe 10 tons of the acre. It's just totally transformed all of it. And so with the harvesting as well, that's now all picked up mechanically. It's no longer ploughed out a furrow at a time, which was, I believe, a very skillful task. And then we put them into bins. The bins are just mounted up like that. And they're ready then for putting onto trailers and then carried back into the grading shed and that. But first of all, they go on to the blowing walls. You notice here that they're all stacked up, the bins. They've got slots underneath them there. That's so the air comes through each of those slots. And then you stop them off, and then the air is then forced up through the bulbs. They must have air through them at all time, night and day. If they don't, they will suffer severely with basal rot. And then we go to the bulb sales. They're no longer sent on trays with a dozen bulbs or sold one at a time. They are just tipped into big trailers, taken down to, or ours are anyway, taken down to Winchester Growers at Penzance. And there they're graded and taken out for the sizes they want for wholesale market. But many now are sold either in bulk by the trailer or in the big ton potato bags that you see. They're used in those now. So things are completely changing. And now we come to the other aspect of growing, and that is we have to treat the bulbs to get rid of all these nasty bugs. And so we have HWT, which is the hot water treatment. And that is where the bulbs are soaked in water for 3 hours at a temperature of 112 degrees Fahrenheit. Now that temperature is critical. If you go above that, you damage the flowers. And you can have a look. I'll leave it. You won't be able to see it from a distance. But that's some that was... Yes, pass it around. That's one that's been damaged by hot water treatment. It affects the flower. And if it is less than that, it will not kill the eelworm, the dreaded eelworm that we want. And when I came to Trenewith first, if I can get it out, there was not much left of the early sterilising system. But they did leave me the old thermometer, and this is one that was used and immersed into the tank as a probe. And the interesting thing about that is that it was Aveling Barford, and I thought, well, this is so old, I'll send it back and have it calibrated so that we get it accurately done. And when I returned it, it came back completely shiny and saying that there was absolutely nothing wrong with it. The accuracy was perfect to within half a degree. Because it only starts measuring it from above 90 degrees. So it's got and it's all marked out with red line and that. But I also had a note from the company that I sent it back. And they didn't know that Aveling and Barford were actually at one time the same firm. And they were quite interested in how I had it. But anyway, it's stamped on it in brass. So I suppose it must be true. Anyway, I'll put that back here before I break it. It is amazingly accurate. To this day, I still calibrate all the electronic ones with that, and they all match up with that. And if they don't, I have it redone. It is absolutely critical. You can do it 1 degree hotter than that, but you have to warm the bulbs first for a week. You have to warm them so to condition the flowers so that it doesn't damage them. But that's costly and expensive, and you do it the minimum that you have to. But I'm afraid now the industry has got very big, and there are now just a few very large players in it. You've got Winchester Growers down at Penzance. They're massive, 2,000, 3,000 acres. You've got Nocton's at Pendarvis at Camborne. They're 1,000 acres. Crouch at Truro is probably that sort of acreage as well. New Generation are a little bit smaller, that have taken over from Rudy Mock at Praise. That's quite interesting. They're a Dutch family that started breeding before the war, his father did and his grandfather, on the Channel Islands. Now, you would have thought that the Channel Islands was better suited for bulb growing than here because it's milder. Well, to a point it was, and I've talked to Mark a lot, and he says, well, it's a bit different, but it's very similar. But the reason they came over here to Cornwall was because of the worldwide distribution. They had no means of getting their flowers to America, to all the markets of the world, which we can do from here just by sending them up either across the ferry into Europe from East Anglia. And they're all shipped from Penzance and dispersed from East Anglia and or from the airports and flown to the States. Climate is very important, but it's not critical. These are some of our better days. It's not always like that around here in the winter, but there are some lovely winter days, and we do get some good weather. Some of you may recognise the fields. And yes, it does vary. It does vary a lot, but there are some nice days, and they seem to enjoy it when it is. But they always pick more flowers on bad weather. That's one thing I've always found over the years. They've got nothing else to do. They don't look at the scenery. When it's bad weather, it's head down and go pick. That's all they ever do. Yes, this worldwide distribution is absolutely essential now. Our flowers go all over the world. The main one is the Dutch auction. They go across to that under the clock auction, where the price just drops, and if you want it, you bid, and it stops, and it's yours. And or else they go direct to Germany. Germany is another big player in it. And the very best of them, but they have to be very green pencil, they go to America. They fetch a premium. Whether the grower actually gets it or not, I don't know. Depends who's down the other end. But we need the big players, because Winchester Grower especially looks after us smaller growers. They take us in as a satellite, that we've got these smaller fields that we can get earlier daffodils, which they cannot get. You've seen these big expanses around Leeds Town and well up the other side of Truro and that. They're vast acres, but they can't beat the early fields, and they can't get their machinery around them. I mean, the machinery that you saw there is very, very tiny compared with theirs. I mean, some of the harvesters you would not get in this room. I mean, they are massive, absolutely huge. But they do have a limitation. Now, a lot of the information that I got from here, I've gained from Andrew Thompson. Andrew Thompson, I know very well. He was a director at Rose Warren, and he's an amazing chap. What he doesn't know about Narcissus production is really not worth knowing. And he's written a lovely book, The Story of Daffodil Growing in Cornwall in the Isles of Scilly. It's called Golden Harvest. And if anybody wants to know anything about the industry in Cornwall, then you could do a lot worse than reading Golden Harvest. I found that an absolutely amazing book. The detail that he goes into, he doesn't dumb it down, but it's in very, very readable form. And I highly recommend it. When Rose Warren closed, Andrew unfortunately lost his job. But Andrew, being Andrew, ever the perfectionist and that, managed to persuade the government to keep a branch of research on the Isles of Scilly. And he spent a number of years there managing at Trenewith Farm, incidentally, on the Isles of Scilly, that they've got an experimental station there. And they've done a lot of work on new varieties of tassettas, which don't, we've got a few around, but not many. But it meant that he still kept in contact with them. And he's developed quite a rapport with the islands, and he's always very much in favour of them. But he still comes over quite a lot. I remember about 5 years ago, Andrew came down to Trenewith. He came to me and asked if he could see our field of sols, because we started growing the tassettas, the sol, and we grew sol d'ors and avalanche. And when I took him down there, he said, "I don't want to see any more. These are as good as we've ever grown on the islands." And he said, "Some of them are not as good as this. So perhaps the tassettas will come over here once more." He says in his book that the three great breeders from Cornwall are P.D. Williams, that's our P.D. Williams at Llanarth, and Alec Gray and Barbara Fry. Alec Gray I've not dealt with, because he bred and raised mostly, in fact almost entirely, miniatures. They're very good as for bulb connect for gardens. He raised Tete-a-Tete, which I'm sure you all know That worldwide. And but there's no flower production in miniature bulbs that I know of anyway, certainly not on a large scale. So I haven't dwelt on that. And of course we have Barbara Fry. St. Cavern has been blessed with these two because there is nothing that will ever be repeated, I think, like P.D. Williams or Barbara Fry. The research stations are closed. It's not being done now. In the future, well, who knows what will happen. Breeding now with genetics and all sort of things like that. They're already talking about trying to get daffodils where the stem and the buds come up before the leaves so they can be mechanically harvested. And that will come, and then I'll complain just as the old men did when they went from their open daffodils and had to pick into buds. It will come. I hope it won't come too soon, but I'm sure it will be around the corner. Now, I've come pretty well to the end of this now. If there's any questions anybody'd like to ask or come up and have a look at any of the stuff that I bought, you're more than welcome. But if you've got any questions, I'll do my best to try and answer them. I see the modern, oh yeah, well, this, yes, it is a modern box of daffodils. Amanda's just reminded me. This is what's, there aren't many of these done now, but if you're using the wholesale market, this is the change to cardboard, which we said when they went away from the wooden ones. They didn't last very long. They're all sent off in plastics now. But that there is about as much colour as they will accept on the wholesale market. It's quite heavy, are you? Yeah, they will be a tiny bit of colour in it, but nothing like what it was before. But for America or for the European exports, we're allowed absolutely no colour whatsoever. They're downgraded if you send them down with the minutest slit. Are there any questions? Sorry?
They're all in bud now, right?
Yes.
So when they do come out, may find maybe one. Do you get any which are faulty after they come out?
You shouldn't do. There's no reason. I know Scrimshaw's, they did research, did a bit of an experiment really, years ago at Trenewith, at Bazaine, on golden harvest. And they started picking them. When the season started, they picked them shorter and shorter, greener and greener, and they got right down, I think if I remember, they got down to 4.5 inches, just as an experiment, and every one opened. Now some varieties may not open quite as well as that, but I would prefer to have them like this with a split sheath, but they will not take them abroad. That's the end of it. Even if you tell them that variety may not open, they will still insist that they are dead green. Dead green, nothing else.
Do they grow any daffodils in America at all?
Sorry?
Do they grow any daffodils in America?
Yes, they actually grow a lot of daffodils in America. Again, about 12, 15 years ago, Bob from the American Bulb Company, for some reason he got my number, I have no idea where from, he used to ring me up every year and ask what the season was like and what was coming over. He was from Michigan. And after I told him exactly what I thought, I'm pretty straightforward and honest like that, and I said it's going to be early, it's going to be late, heavy or light, and he did this for years. And I said, well, why do you buy daffodils from us when you've got so many in the southern states of America, vast acres of them? And he said, well, it's quite simple, really. From California, when there are some, I get 3 flights a week. From the UK, I can get 5 flights a day. And it's purely the logistics of getting them over. But having said that, there's more bulbs, daffodil bulbs, grown in the UK than anywhere else in the world. We far outstrip Holland now, and the bulk of that, well, almost entirely, the early production now comes from Cornwall, then moves to East Anglia, and then finally now they'll be finishing off picking in Scotland. So we are definitely right at the front edge of it still. It's nice to think it has started, or a lot of it started around here. Hello at the back.
Well, you mentioned the word narcissus earlier. Is there a difference between a daffodil and a narcissus?
Well, no, the rule of thumb is that if they're the multi-headed ones, they're usually referred to as tessetas, and the narcissus refers to the daffodil, which is the yellow trumpet or the double flowers. They're always muddled up, whichever way they're referred to. They all come from the narcissus, pseudo-narcissus of Tenby, that sort of thing, you know? But it's usually the tessetas are kept separate, and they're crossed with matadors, and that they're the bigger tessetas. If you've got the small one, Soldor is the true tesseta, and if you've got the bigger heads, there's a Dan Duplessis or a Mike Pollock around somewhere lurking in the back, I think, possibly. Is there? No, none here. They've got the bigger head. They've got a bigger head and a bigger cup, and they are crossed with matadors. They're matador crosses. Yes.
When did the daffodil growing start in East Anglia? How much later were they than?
Sorry, when it started in
East Anglia.
Yes. How much later?
Later than was 1870 here.
I think the daffodil industry started throughout the country at about the same time, but we had our geographical differences, which meant that the Isles of Scilly went off their way with tessetas and that, and then we came on first, and then Lincolnshire. When I started growing daffodils, we had at least a fortnight's difference, nearly 3 weeks, between Cornwall and Lincolnshire. But now that difference has got down to less than 10 days, and some years it's no more than a week. They've taken the earlier varieties from Cornwall, and they're now growing them. So everybody's jumping over everybody else, really. But the climatic change that has affected daffodil growing, what's going to be the future, I don't know. We've had it this year. It's been an appalling year. We had the two cold snaps. We were running early. We had the first cold snap that put us on time. That was brilliant. But then we had the second cold snap, which lasted for over 2 weeks, and that made it late. And then that was then followed by a very warm, mild spell, and everything all crashed in together. And in fact, this season is at least 3 or 4 weeks shorter than a normal season. And that's why all the daffodils are around. But we had the flowers. It was a fantastic flower count this year. But, you know, it had been shortened so much, and we couldn't harvest them. And perhaps a good job. If we had, the price would have been even lower. So it followed a very good year, the exact opposite last year. Last year was much better and much more sensible.
As a grower, how could you keep daffodils for a long time once you bought them from you?
Well, we really don't keep them for a long time at all. We plant them usually it was 2 years, now it's usually 3 years because of the cost of harvesting them. And we lift them up every year, and then we clean them up, split them up, grade them, and put them back. So the young ones go back. And so you're changing, you're rotating your stock every 3 years. And we don't put them in the same ground unless we have to for less than 7 years. So it's quite a long gap between them, and that keeps them fresh and rejuvenated. But they go on and on for a long time.
And also, once you bought them to take home, how could you suggest that you keep them to prolong their life once you've got them indoors? Is there any room?
Well, no. I think that one of the problems with the daffodil, I've always thought, is it's a very cheap flower. It's probably the cheapest of all the flowers, and it tends to be, I think, be used in the kitchen, and it's you know, you have a little fort, and which is often the hottest room in the house, and it's really to do with that. If you were to get two bunches of daffodils, put one in your kitchen and one in your sitting room or somewhere which you use perhaps once a week, much cooler at night, you'll find that the ones exactly the same bunches, they will last probably 4 or 5 days longer in a cooler room. There isn't much you can do about it. Just, you know, keep fresh water, chop the ends off when you get them about 1/4 inch, and that's about it, really.
What happened to Barbara Fry? Did she end up as a very wealthy woman?
No, not at all. Very humble woman. Very nice. I remember I really got talking to her by default, really, because Andrew Thompson it was that took me over and introduced me to Barbara Fry. And she was just going around shaking every hand. And he said, he farms at Trenowith, it's in Cavern. And she came straight back and started talking to me as if I was there when she was. Was such and such in that field? Do they still breed them? And some of her seedlings, I'm sure, are still dotted around the hedges. I keep looking for them. I haven't seen anything that's particularly unusual or remarkable. But she was very interested. No, a very humble woman. Traveled the world getting all her seedlings. A lot sent over from America. She was internationally renowned for it. But no, as far as I know, she was not a wealthy woman. The money was made by those that grew the daffodils that she reared. The seedlings that she produced were amazing. And I was told, I won't name the grower, but many years ago, well, about 5 years ago, that he said he had made over £1 million out of Tamara. That's the selling of the flowers and the selling of the bulbs. When I bought Tamara, it was £3,000 a tonne. Now it's only sort of £300. It's just an ordinary daffodil now. But they were colossal. There was a lot of money made by it.
When you invent one, you can't patent it or anything.
Well, you don't invent them. No, when you cross them over, you cross-pollinate them and you get them. You don't know what you're going. You aim for certain characteristics, earliness, sturdiness, colour, height, all sorts that you do. But when you get them, you then register them. You get them recorded as being yours and you registered them. A classic example is RES, that one we showed that was cut. That there was... Nobody really knows who reared it. And it's the earliest of all the daffodils, but the chap that registered it was von Reinsfeld. And it's all known now as Reinsfeld's early sensation. But he did not raise that seedling, he just registered it. But if you do register it, but then anybody can... You know, can have that if you sell it. Where the plant breeders' rights go from there on, I don't know. I don't want to go down that road. But once they come into the market, they multiply so quickly. You have to remember now that the propagation techniques that they're using with microchipping, and they're almost down to the cellular stage now, that they can, from a bulb, you can get thousands within a couple of years, and it's no problem. The problem is, if you happen to get a bulb that's not quite perfect, you're multiplying the imperfection as well, and it won't be rogued out because there's so many of them. But the multiplication of stocks now is it's incredible. It used to take 10 years to get one bulb up to 10 tons. That took 10 years, and then another 10 years of testing that. So it took probably 20 years from the actual seedling to get it into commercial production, but that's now slashed down, I should think, probably to more than 4 or 5.
What do you do with the, if the daffodil bulb and the daffodil row, they multiply, at what rate?
Oh, it depends on the variety. This was, again, one of the problems when the enthusiasts, they would breed them for a perfect bloom, but they often didn't reproduce very quickly, and there was no stocks of them. And a great number of them died out because they weren't strong enough to keep multiplying. But you'll get others that'll grow like weeds. It'll just go on and on and on. A lot of it depends what diseases they pick up en route.
John, you mentioned colour.
I mentioned what?
Colour. I'll give that a colour of some of these dads.
Colour.
Yes, you know, daffodils are usually viewed as a host of gold and daffodils, but what about variations? You've got some white with red centres. Is there anything else in the pipeline, you know, like...
Oh, well, I hope not. I don't know. I mean, I'm a bit of a purist, really. I'm not mad about doubles, and they're all right, but to me, a daffodil will always be a yellow trumpet. And I don't have a lot of sympathy for anything else much, not really. Some of the white ones are quite nice, but I always say if you give a child a box of crayons and a sheet of paper, they will always draw a golden harvest, which is a yellow trumpet daffodil. And that's what I think they should be, early, mid and late.
There's one who ended up with some smart person might produce a superb one.
Anyway, are there any more questions, or is that it? Any more questions? That's it? Right.
job. I mean, I know you put a lot of work into that. It didn't look like you do it on a regular basis, so we thank you very much.
No, I never have anything to do with daffodils at all.
I could say you know your onions, but in your case, you don't know daffodils. Thank you very much. One thing which I can ask you any time. Maximus Superbus is, you know where they were bred down for now.
Yes, they were.
They didn't last that long from a commercial point.
No. Maximus Superbus was one of those that was very long, very thin stem, and a beautiful yellow trumpet, lovely yellow trumpet, and a bit like a thinner version of King Alfred. But it just falls by the... Oh, thank you very much. I remember talking to old man Scrimshaw, and he said that when he started growing cattle, that was in Lincolnshire, probably in the... Well, must have been just after the Second World War. He said, we grew flowers like this. This is what he said, I grew flowers. And then, after that, they bred them so that we breed buds. We wanted big, fat buds. And now all they breed is just stems. You just want them thicker and shorter. And you've got them, you're 11 and a half length, and the Maximus would nowhere near come into that. I mean, you know, you could get Maximus up 2 foot in it. So it just faded by.
Because you know that hill that, like, down there by the sewage works.
Yep.
I mean, that was like nearly 30 years ago when Captain Cook came out. And the ones that were left there, they flowered for years and years, and they're still flowering.
Yeah.
And so there's no problem with, what, wireworm?
Well, they're nothing, they're eelworm. I mean, they must be eelworm as well. I mean, I grew some on the field just above them, didn't I? I mean, you wouldn't have done that if I thought there was eelworm there. No, if they survived that long, it's like the old wild daffodils, you know, the Lent Lily. I mean, they didn't get decimated. They plodded away through for hundreds of years. It's, you know, crossing them around, sometimes you've weakened them, I think, for two various things.
I agree.